It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And a proposal to build Wisconsin's largest hog farm near the small town of Trade Lake in Burnett County has divided the community, sparked lawsuits, and challenged state regulators. Although the state has twice rejected this proposal, the project is still being considered and under review. We have a link to our guest's three-part series on this story at WPR.org/mornings. And you can join with your comment and experience if you are in Burnett County or you have questions about the push and pull between small town Wisconsin and larger agriculture operations. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Bennett Goldstein reports on water and agriculture as a Report for America journalist with Wisconsin Watch. Bennett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So your three-part series called Hogtied is about this proposed hog feeding facility in northwest Burnett County. What's some of the controversy surrounding this $20 million project?
Yeah, so the project known as Cumberland, it was a proposed and is still, you know, as you said, still is proposed hog breeding operation that first emerged in 2019, and it immediately sparked a lot of alarm due to the setting in Trade Lake, Wisconsin, which is largely a vacation town and has a combination of vacation homes and farming. And it's about 70, 80 miles northeast of the Twin Cities area. So you get a kind of a diverse group of people who are living together.
And as I understand it, the town board chairman at the time was involved, at least to some degree, in the transaction of land for this project?
Yes. The former town board chairman, his name is Jim Moline. He first met with the developer shortly after the developer, whose name is Jeff Sauer, came to the town and had discussed the possibility of giving his land where the project would be sited. And when he did that, you know, he also had discussed the possibility of obtaining manure from the project. While at the same time, he was also in charge of directing meetings and, just kind of orchestrating, how the community would respond to the project. And it became apparent to residents that, they alleged that he tried to prevent them from taking action to prevent this CAFO from coming to the community, in his capacity as the town board chair, which led to a lawsuit against him.
Bennett, give us a picture here. As currently proposed, what would this animal pig breeding facility look like?
Yeah, so, I mean, it would be, I think in the story we framed it, in a couple of different ways, to try to put it in a picture that maybe people can relate to. I mean, this facility would be the size of roughly 2.5 Home Depot box stores, a really massive operation with, in its original design, it would have held more than 26,000 pigs, which, and most of those would be piglets because they're being bred and then raised until they can be shipped to either Iowa or Minnesota, where then they would grow to a larger size before they're slaughtered for food. It also would be positioned, close to the town community and, within like a mile and a half of the farm itself, there are about 15 residences. It really did spark a lot of concern among local residents who feared what the impacts could be environmentally, to their property values,
Yeah, what kind of
and
waste
to
would we
also
be
their
talking?
health.
Yeah, Bennett, what kind of waste would we be talking about from a facility like this?
Yeah, so I mean, you're each, so as the pigs live, they, produce excrement, and so that would fall through the bottom of the floor through slats into a collection pit. And that I think each year in the plan was to roughly like 10 Olympic swimming pools worth of manure,
A
and
year?
that has to go somewhere. Yeah, a year.
Well, as part of the plan here, as I understand it from your story, and again, Bennett Goldstein, reporter for the investigative news outlet Wisconsin Watch, with his three-part series, Hogtied. You can find it at WPR.org/mornings. We've got a link there. So the residents, some residents of Trade Lake sued the town chair at the time, Jim Moline. And through this legal process, they learned a few things about what was going on. Like the several area property owners found out that manure from the proposed pig farm was designated to be spread on their fields, but the property owners said they never gave permission for this and they complained to state regulators. Tell me, Bennett, what kind of oversight authority does the state have in situations like these?
Yeah, so I mean, the state is in charge of making sure that anyone who proposes a farm of this size has the ability to safely dispose of the manure in a way that maximizes their crop yields, but also protects water quality. And that's their priority, and so they have to. So the plan, when someone plans this farm, they have to submit a plan that indicates where they intend to dispose of this. And it turned out that a lot of property owners had for years been renting their land to the Moline family for farming. And the Molines, when you grow crops, you do have to fertilize the fields. And so they had used a combination of commercial fertilizer and manure from their cattle. But at a certain point when this farm, Cumberland, was planned, the manure source would have changed to commercial and pig manure. And that was what the landowners had not been aware of and had not given their consent to. And it turns out that a lot of those landowners actually opposed the farm. So this was quite alarming to them when they found out that they would incidentally kind of be part of this plan.
And is this an isolated incident when we're looking at large-scale animal farms in Wisconsin and finding that some of this waste is being spread on places that were not permitted or at least did not get permission to do it?
So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because there have been cases where other facilities, CAFOs, where the landowners also have objected to manure spreading on their property. Another case involving a different pig farm proposal was called Badgerwood, and that was up north. And in a very similar situation, it played out that landowners, discovered that they didn't want pig manure on their property, and they had also been included in the plan. And once they informed the state, that kind of sets off, when enough landowners do alert the state to that, it sets off alarm bells, and the state can require then that the developers contact them and provide them with evidence, whether it's documentation of agreements that indicate that they have the landowner's permission to do so.
Bennett Goldstein, our guest. He reports on water and agriculture as a Report for America journalist for Wisconsin Watch. His three-part series, Hogtied, details the small community of Trade Lake in Burnett County and the proposal for a large animal breeding operation there. And some of the contentiousness that has arisen as a result, and a question about where we're going as a state and where small town Wisconsin is moving in terms of the economy. And you can join us with your questions or comments at any time here, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. And what happens when a town with less than 1,000 residents goes up against a $20 million proposal for an animal farm that could house around 20,000 pigs? Well, our guest is Bennett Goldstein, a Report for America journalist with Wisconsin Watch. And in December, Wisconsin Watch published Bennett's three-part series titled Hogtied that covers what's been happening in northwest Burnett County over the last 4 years. You can find a link to that on our website at wpr.org/mornings. And we invite you to be part of the conversation by calling in with your questions about concentrated animal feeding operations, or your comments are also welcome at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. So, Bennett, the state's twice rejected this Cumberland proposal for the animal farm breeding facility in Trade Lake. But last May, the developer proposed a scaled-down facility that would still house 19,800 pigs. Who will have the final say on whether this facility is built?
Yeah, so it's up to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to make sure that the application fulfills, a set of requirements, and, the developer has to submit design plans and specifications, and also a manure spreading plan.
Where does the Cumberland proposal currently stand?
So ever since the application was, the most recent application, which was submitted in May, nothing additional has been submitted, and it was only roughly the proposal itself. It wasn't even the full application. So at this point, it's pending, and the state awaits word from the developer.
Let's go to your calls and comments now at 1-800-642-1234. Chris in Port Wing, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having this important show. I wanted to point one other additional issue to the CAFO world is that CAFOs are a major contributor to climate change gases, and it's causing a serious problem. CAFOs reduce the number of farmers by increasing the intensity of the farm, and sustainable farming, like we do promote with CSAs and things in the state here, employ many more people than CAFOs will, and they'll produce food like pigs and cows and vegetables much more sustainably while not contributing to climate change. So thanks for having the show. It's really important.
Thanks for the perspective, Chris. And Bennett, you report on water and agriculture as a Report for America journalist. What about the nexus between economies of scale for agriculture and their effects on the community?
Yeah, the biggest problem, it kind of all goes back to how do you safely dispose of the waste that's produced by the animals that you're raising. And so, as the name suggests, when you're concentrating this many animals, I think in a smaller area, then you really have to be careful with it.
We're talking about a proposed concentrated animal operation in northwest Wisconsin. Bennett Goldstein, our guest, and you can join us as well, 800-642-1234. So after this hog farm was proposed in Trade Lake in 2019, a couple of other communities around Trade Lake took notice. Five nearby towns enacted ordinances aimed at regulating how these concentrated animal feedlots are operated. Business and farm groups then began to challenge those laws. So what's the status of these local ordinances trying to control what comes into their community in terms of size and waste from these farms?
Yeah. After the large farm was proposed, a group of six townships kind of perceived gaps in state regulations over these operations. And so they decided to look at what they could do to regulate how they run, not ban them outright, but look at things like safety plans and how they would respond to fires and how they would if there was a disease outbreak, how they would manage the disposal of animal carcasses, if there was a mass mortality event. And so they decided to team up and look at what they could legally pass. And then, let's see, so it ended up being five of them enacted ordinances that would control the operations. And at some point, one of them was challenged in court by the state's business lobby. Rather than the court case moving forward, it ended up not being resolved through litigation because the town eventually decided to rescind its ordinance.
State's business lobby that you mentioned there, is at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce?
Yes.
Yeah. So the bigger picture then, how much authority do local governments and the state have when it comes to regulating these large-scale animal farm operations?
Yeah, I mean, so that it kind of remains an open question, and it depends who you ask. So even though that lawsuit was rendered moot because the ordinance was rescinded, another one of these townships has now been the precursor to a lawsuit has been filed against them, and so that if this goes to court, it may we might see the same thing play out again. But local governments, especially the ones that have passed these ordinances, would argue and tell you that, well, we have a state statute does provide authority for us to take these steps, like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce say that, the exact opposite, that state statute limits what local governments can do. And it's, it's a, at this point, untested area of law.
Bennett Goldstein from Report for America journalist for Wisconsin Watch. And again, his three-part series, Hogtied, can be found online at WPR.org/mornings. Donna from Sun Prairie would like to hear about what you know about the odor could be from large pig farms like these, Bennett. Donna says they've passed by small pig farms and they consider the odor unbearable. And you've got some perspective, at least I think one study from your story on this.
Yeah, so there was a university researcher in Illinois who looked at, produced a modeling study as to what residents might expect if this was constructed. And I think it was, roughly half the week, on any given day, odors might be detectable by, up to 15 and a half miles away from it. Hmm. Certainly that, fact, has been disputed. But one thing that comes up, and this kind of comes down to who's living in the area. A lot of farmers in Burnett and the neighboring county where the lawsuit occurred, would argue, look, this is a rural area and people who live here should come to expect that on days when we spread manure, that you're going to smell it. And that's, farming, is not always, the picturesque business that we like to think of it as. Some days it does smell, and that's just the nature of the job. And if you want to live in this part of the country, then you just have to come to accept that and then appreciate it on days when it doesn't smell. But for people who are living in the community, who aren't farming, I mean, it really can affect their quality of life. And so there, they would argue that, it's not so much, that I have nothing against you farming, but when it starts to affect my ability to enjoy my property and my life, You know, that's where we have some conflict.
Hey, Bennett, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you.
Bennett Goldstein reports on water and agriculture as a Report for America journalist for Wisconsin Watch. An in-depth article called three-piece series called Hogtied, available now for you. Check it out when you get a chance, wpr.org/mornings. And if you miss any part of today's show or any show going back in time, you can visit our program page and find hundreds of morning show programs in our archives. Visit wpr.org/mornings. Free to stream or download, whatever you want to do with it, it's yours as much as ours. Thanks in part because of support from generous listeners like you. Again, that's wpr.org/mornings. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and according to Retraction Watch, more than 380 research papers studying COVID-19 have been retracted so far. For example, the study that claimed COVID vaccines kill five times more people over 65 than they save, that was published in the journal Toxicology Reports in September of 2021, and it was not retracted until 8 months later, well after any damage had been done. You can join in by calling with your questions or comments about retracted research, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest to give us a deeper look at this, Elizabeth Selzer, is an application support analyst for the Advocate Health Midwest Library at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee. And Liz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Ivan Oransky is co-founder of Retraction Watch, the editor-in-chief of The Transmitter, and a distinguished journalist in residence at New York University's Arthur Carter Journalism Institute. Ivan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
So every year, thousands of published academic papers are retracted due to flawed data, plagiarism, poor methods, or other errors. And Ivan, I'll start with you. What are your concerns about these retractions?
Well, Lee, you know, my concerns are actually almost not even with the retractions. It's with all the papers that aren't being retracted that should be. But I will start by saying that about two-thirds of these retractions are for something that we would all either agree or likely agree is misconduct. So that's, as you mentioned, plagiarism. It's making up data. It's making data look better than they really are. What this says to us is that peer review, which is this idea and actually practice where peers, in other words, other experts, are supposed to review studies before they're published and sort of give them, well, according to some journals and publishers, a sort of stamp of approval, but really it's just sort of a, yeah, this passes the initial sniff test, isn't really catching all these problems. And I think we just need to be honest about that. But the bigger issue, again, is that so many papers that should be retracted, in fact, aren't being retracted. So there's a lot more problematic literature out there than even those thousands of retractions would suggest. And as a final comment, I'll just say that those thousands of retractions are still, you know, somewhere between 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 papers being published every year. So I think it's important to say that this is still a pretty rare event.
So, Liz Selzer, the journal Nature says we set a record last year for the number of academic research papers that had to be retracted. What are your concerns about these retractions?
Well, I think that retractions is, or the process of going through a retraction is showing that the science is working and the process is working. Not everything that we publish is infallible, and we can't, sometimes it takes another set of eyes or other people looking at the research in order to determine that it was incorrect. And it's okay to be incorrect, and it's okay to correct what's been published. But like Ivan said, the length of and the process of going through a retraction takes a long time. And while these papers with their flawed data are out in the public, people are using them to influence their own research. And there's wasted time there. There's wasted money, a lot of waste.
Yeah, Liz, what does a retraction process generally look like?
So you mentioned that it took about 8 months to get the COVID article retracted, and that is actually a pretty quick timeline. When for the formal retraction process to take place, there's a lot of people who need to be involved. You've got the editors and the publishers, people at the institution where the research was being conducted, and review boards. So these groups need to come together and go through the steps. So first of all, somebody might contact a journal or institution saying, I think there's a problem with this paper that's recently been published. And then that gets sent to the institution where the research was being done. And any institution that's getting federal funding from the National Institutes of Health or the federal government, other sources, they need to have in place a process to review any misconduct. So that process, through that process, they would take on the complaint and then investigate it. And the investigation process involves really doing due diligence to make sure that the complaint addresses or the complaint actually involves misconduct. And then everybody involved in the project needs to be involved, and the data needs to be picked through to see where the errors might have occurred. And this process can take months to happen. You've got a lot of people involved in it, looking at the data. And then, if misconduct is said to have been found, then the head of the institution can recommend that the article gets retracted. So that's months to a year at that point. And then the journal has to issue a notice of retraction saying this article was published, we're retracting it, and here are the reasons why. And then the journal needs to make sure that any copies of that article on their website are labeled as being retracted. And they also need to filter that data down to any place on the internet that might have the article, like PubMed, which is a popular database for searching for medical literature or any type of research. They need to get the update so they can update their records saying that these articles have been retracted.
And
So,
in the retraction
lengthy
process,
process.
yeah, but once they decide to retract, are journals going through this entire process? Is it easy for others to find when a study's been retracted?
So, I've done a couple of research papers on this, and we've looked at the patterns and how retracted publications are being labeled, and it's really all over the board. So different journals have different ways of labeling their papers as being retracted. There's recommendations in place on what should happen, but the recommendations are pretty vague, and they're not saying like stamp all the PDFs with retraction. They're just saying label it, and how the label appears can sometimes be hard to find on some papers. So that part is a little messy.
That's Liz Seltzer from the Advocate Health Midwest Library in Milwaukee. Also joining us, Ivan Oransky, who is a co-founder of Retraction Watch. And Ivan, are we to be reassured by this increase in these research papers being retracted? Is this a cause for concern? How do you see the recent rise?
I think much, if not in fact, all of the recent rise is due to better screening. In other words,
Okay.
people actually looking for problems, which, it's not great that misconduct happened or that, frankly, that errors happened. About 20% of these are due to what I think most people would agree are sort of honest errors. But I think we have to also look at the fact that there's been a dramatic rise over the past few years because of something called paper mills. Now, paper mills that, listeners might know about are making literal paper. These are sort of metaphorical paper mills, if you'd like. But what they do is they actually sell papers to authors, researchers who are under tremendous pressure. Publish or perish is a very real thing. And in many parts of the world, it's even more intense than it might be elsewhere. And so it's actually an economically good decision, believe it or not, for some authors to, or at least short-term economically good decision, for authors to buy a paper instead of doing the research themselves, or even buying authorship. I mean, people buy authorship on papers that have already been accepted. That means two people are committing misconduct, one that sold the authorship, the other one that bought the authorship. And this is all, again, because of publish or perish. And I think that's, if you want to pull back and look at the root causes, the thing to be concerned about is the incentive structure that researchers are laboring under, which is pretty intense. And I'm actually pretty sympathetic to how much pressure these researchers are under. So we should be actually somewhat reassured in that journals are starting to take, and universities and government agencies are starting to take this much more seriously. Adam Marcus and I co-founded Retraction Watch in 2010, so 13 and a half years ago now. And at the time, not all that many people were particularly focused on retractions or signs of misconduct. There were some, absolutely, but this was sort of an untapped set of stories, which is why we launched the thing. And now you can't, especially nowadays, as we're all talking today, we're all sort of, I think, all reading still about the Harvard case, which a couple of Harvard cases, but the Harvard president, of course, and that some, allegations of plagiarism. Stanford president stepped down, as did the Harvard one just recently. And so there's much more attention being paid, which is a good thing. But we really still need to take a look back, not just at sort of, okay, what sanctions should we have? What punishment should we have for this bad behavior? But actually, what's leading to the bad behavior? And that is honestly a much more almost, existential question for academia.
I gotta have an email here from Haley, ideas@WPR.org, and they want to know what happens when retracted research is cited in other research. And if a researcher publishes and cites a retracted article, does that author get notified of the retraction? So, how does this influence other research? Liz, I'll ask you.
So, or articles that have been retracted, can still be cited, and sometimes they're being cited because as a case that says this is a bad paper and here's the reasons why. But I think you need to look at the reason why the original article was retracted and the reasons why the person who cited it was using it. So were they using it as just a background example of prior research that's been done, or were they using the actual data from the article? And if it's the second point, I think, the citing author, it would behoove them to go back and take a look at their studies and self-correct. But that, is a process. The person has to figure out that the paper they cited has been retracted. So that is...
How do they find that out?
How do they find that out?
After the fact.
There's different tools. So a lot of researchers use a citation manager to store the documents that they're finding online. And if you use a citation manager like EndNote or Zotero, it's a software where you can deposit PDFs of articles or just the basic citation information. These citation managers actually link to Retraction Watch. So every time you open them up, they kind of call out to Retraction Watch and say, has anything in my library been retracted? And if so, a big X will show up on their screen. So they can be aware of that pretty quickly as soon as Retraction Watch has that information. So then they can kind of start to take the steps to say, what data was I using? Is this integral to my paper? Do I need to issue some sort of correction or whatnot about my research?
So the tools are there and available.
Tools are there, and Ivan's Retraction Watch has made this so much easier to identify these papers. Before citation managers were doing this, it was really, one by one looking through your library and periodically checking, has this been retracted? Has it not? And that is,
process.
People aren't likely to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Liz Selzer, an application support analyst for the Advocate Health Midwest Library at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee. Also joining us, Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch, the largest database in the world of research papers that have been retracted. And you can call in with your questions or comments, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. And when errors and bad data are found in academic papers published in scientific journals, it can take years to retract them. Meanwhile, the debunked work continues to be cited by other researchers. So what can the scientific community do to protect sound science from disproven and unsubstantiated research? That's why we have our guest with us this morning, Liz Selzer from the Advocate Health Midwest Library, and Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch. And Ivan, and you can join the conversation as well. Academics, 800-642-1234. Questions about how we are to understand the science and the retraction process, and how we can reaffirm the scientific method. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I would be curious to know, Ivan, from the perspective of Retraction Watch, are retractions more common in some fields of study than others?
Lee, it's a great question, one that we get asked a lot. And the short answer is yes. But what often is lurking behind that question is sort of an assumption that that means certain fields have more problems, right? So the issue, though, is that not all fields are, frankly, taking this issue seriously. So there have been various fields over time, over the past, you know, give or take 15 years, that have had a sort of, if you will, taking themselves to the woodshed moment. So a big scandal will happen, and often it'll get a lot of airplay, you know, a lot of news coverage. And that field will say, wait a second, you know, if it's a mature field that's actually trying to do the right thing, it'll say, okay, we should really take a deeper look here. You know, we, if for no other reason, we don't want to be caught unawares, and hopefully even for better reasons, which is let's clean things up. Let's make sure that our work and what we publish and what we cite is as trustworthy as possible. So if you look at fields like social psychology, which had a big scandal about 12 years ago now, 12, 13 years ago now, a guy named Diedrich Stoppel, who turned out to have been making up all his data, they had that moment and then realized, okay, we have a problem. So there seemed to be more attractions in that field, but that's probably because they're looking. Same thing was with anesthesiology. It's a field that punches above their weight, so to speak, in terms of retractions. That actually is part of why we launched Retraction Watch, is that Adam Marcus, my co-founder, had broken a big story about someone doing pain management research and who, again, also was making up all of the data in his trials. And so there are a number of fields like that. Cancer biology is another one where it appears like there, and in fact, there are more attractions in those areas, but it really is because they've actually started looking. So if anything, we should trust those fields more.
Liz, one story from Retraction Watch here reported that a University of Wisconsin-Madison review committee found duplication and mislabeling in a 2017 paper published in the journal Science Signaling. But it took the editor of the journal 3 years before beginning the process of retracting that paper. What can we do to expedite, what can be done to expedite the process of retraction of these research papers?
You know, that was a very unusual case, and it's the retraction complaint seemed to have just sat on the editor's desk. So I'm not sure what the workflow is for that journal. But you know, that this is all done kind of in silos. So if others might have been aware of that complaint had been made, perhaps pressure could have been put on the journal to expedite the process. But I think for, you know, reducing retracted information or getting the retracted articles through the process more quickly, if people are using, or if the data and articles are more open to reviews. So we've got the peer review process that Ivan mentioned, which is a couple of people reading an article and giving their stamp of approval on it. But say these articles are put into something like a preprint server. So before it's being published, it could be put in a preprint area labeled not as official, but it would allow people who are in the know of that area to really give it a good once over. And even better than just reading the article before it's been printed, if we make the data available. So instead of just sitting on this, you know, fraudulent data and having it just saved locally on your own computer, what if that data could be put somewhere in an open environment? So anybody who has interest in it can look at it and start either using it to build upon or noticing if there's been any errors made, and this could be corrected before an official version of the article has been published.
Liz Selzer's from the Advocate Health Midwest Library in Milwaukee. Our other guest, Ivan Oransky, is the co-founder of Retraction Watch. And Ivan, Retraction Watch has reported on a physician formerly affiliated with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health who co-authored a paper about a hospital protocol to radically reduce deaths from COVID-19. Sounds good, but that paper ultimately had to be retracted. What are some of the consequences that researchers face when they are faced with retraction?
Yeah, you know, it's a really wide range. That particular case, I A lot of details, a lot of wonder under that bridge. I think we all know that during the pandemic, the scientific community has been, I think, in a good way, really trying to rush and to get things done. And that has led to some sloppiness, but also to some bad behavior and bad faith actors. The range for retractions, it sort of depends on what happened. One of the things that's really important, and Liz referred to retraction notices, which run alongside, the actual withdrawal, retraction of that article, those should be very forthright about what actually happened. And it turns out that when a retraction happens for what, again, colloquially we would say is honest error, there's no negative consequence for those researchers, and in fact, for that field. And sometimes there's even some evidence that they get a bump in sort of reputation as measured by citations and things. But more to the point, there isn't actually a drop. Whereas if there is a retraction or a series of retractions for misconduct, for fraud, a number of things can happen. One is that depending on whether or not the university, the federal government in the states or elsewhere has funded the research, there can be an investigation. A lot of people who've had a lot of retractions are no longer working in science. You can actually be sanctioned in terms of losing the ability to, you're banned from federal funding or your federal funding has to be supervised. Those are the rare cases, though. And I've been quoted saying, and I think it's still the case, that the most likely outcome for someone who commits fraud in science is a long and productive career. And that's because so many cases are not being looked at. The incentives for universities, for agencies, for journals to look at these issues are really not there. In fact, they're quite the opposite. And so we don't have as much vigilance and sort of policing, if you will, that, as we should. That being said, when there's a major case, often the fact that the press reports on it can pressure the relevant people to do the right thing.
With the time we have left here is about a minute, Ivan. Would be the one thing we could do to see journals improve how they handle retractions?
Well, I think somehow decoupling, tenure, promotion, all of that stuff, and your career from publishing in certain journals or even any journal would really do a lot. In terms of the journals themselves, some of them actually are. They hire research integrity managers. They hire staffs to actually look at these issues when they come up or even before they come up. That's a good step. And some are actually screening for problems, before they happen or as papers are coming in. Yep. Those are all good things, and it'd be great if more did that.
Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch, the editor-in-chief of The Transmitter and a distinguished journalist in residence at New York University's Arthur Carter Journalism Institute. Thank you for joining us this morning. Also, Liz Selzer, thank you to you, application support analyst for the Advocate Health Midwest Library at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you've been listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.